UFO contacts from a frequency raised level of awareness, from and near the so-called astral level of matter vibrations. But when those people began telling of their experiences, they were ridiculed, because almost none of them describe the higher vibratory level of those experiences, as they simply did not understand their actual sensing through their own higher so-called etheric or astral body, when most of those experiences occurred.
What is a contactee? In its strictest sense, the term refers to anyone who sees a being emerge from a flying saucer, then has a conversation or other interaction with that being. Contactees are often invited aboard and given a tour of the saucer, or even a ride. They may also be given a message to deliver to humanity. Despite the disbelief, ridicule, and accusations of delusion or outright fabrication that are sure to be heaped upon them, dozens of contactees have come forward. They have provided us with detailed accounts of their encounters, and with overwhelming evidence for the extraterrestrial origin of flying saucers. Let's take a look at some of these accounts. Amazing Tales. I have selected the following accounts for their credibility, and for the explicit evidence they provide, evidence that flying saucers are spacecraft from other planets. All date back to the 1950s, the heyday of contact literature. G. Truman Betheram, a husky, jovial-looking man. Truman Betheram was employed, during the summer of 1952, with a road crew in the Mojave Desert. One afternoon he left the work site and drove off into the desert. After spending some time in search of a souvenir shells, he fell asleep in his truck. Betheram awoke to find the truck surrounded by 8 or 9 short, Latin-looking men, with expressionless faces. They wore uniforms that resembled those of Greyhound bus drivers. The men escorted him to a flying saucer that was hovering over the desert brush. Inside the ship, he was led down a hallway and through a door-like opening into the office of the captain. "I think my eyes fairly popped," he tells us in Aboard a Flying Saucer, Divorce & Co., 1954, "as I saw their captain was a gorgeous woman, shorter than any of the men, neatly attired, and also having a Latin appearance. The captain, stylishly outfitted in a beret, black velvet blouse, and red skirt, introduced herself as Aura Rains of the planet Clarion. Her ship had landed," she told Betheram, "in order to replenish its air tanks, to allow the crew a respite, and, the reason for his being contacted, to help the people of Earth reaffirm old-fashioned values." She talked about her home planet. Betheram would learn, during this and subsequent contacts with Rains, that Clarion is a utopia. It has no poverty, armies, nuclear devices, cars, or taxes. Its people are religious, friendly, and trusting. They love to dance. And they never hurry. Finally, she assured Betheram that they would meet again, and he was escorted back to his truck. George Van Tassel. In 1947, George Van Tassel, a mechanic for an aircraft manufacturer, decided he had had enough of Los Angeles. Quitting his job, he moved with his wife and 3 daughters to the sparsely populated Yucca Valley, in the Mojave Desert. The land he had leased came with a natural wonder, a 60-foot-high boulder known as Giant Rock. Beneath the rock was a grotto, and in it the family set up their home, gracing the rough stone with furniture, books, and piano. Also on the property was a dirt airstrip. Alongside it, Van Tassel built a restaurant and other facilities, and opened an airport. The Van Tassels were pleased with their move. They had exchanged the ills of the city for the austere beauty of the desert. Surrounding them now were miles of unspoiled terrain, with its wildlife, cacti, and sculptured rocks. At night the sky was crowded with stars. The air was clean and invigorating. But dwelling in the desert had another advantage, one that had become important to Van Tassel, and that was the improved radio reception. For he had begun to scan the bands, and monitor messages from space. Extraterrestrial beings, he had discovered, were trying to communicate with us. He wrote and published a book on the subject. Then, on August 24, 1953, the beings themselves arrived. Van Tassel, along with his wife, was sleeping outdoors the night when he was awakened by someone standing over him. "I am Solgrinder. I would be pleased to show you our craft," said the stranger, a tall man in a jumpsuit. Van Tassel tried to rouse his wife, but she had been jumpsuits were already familiar to many Americans as the standard garb of spacemen, thanks to such sartorially prophetic films as The Day the Earth Stood Still, 1951. Placed under some kind of control. Climbing out of his sleeping bag, he followed Solgrinder to a luminous disk that hovered near giant rock. Van Tassel stared in amazement. Was he dreaming? Solgrinder led him inside, introduced him to the rest of the crew, and explained that the ship was from Venus. Van Tassel was given a tour. He viewed the ship's main cabin, a circular space with a central column, the control room, and the propulsion chamber, where he noted with professional interest a set of counter-wheeling rotors. He was told that the Venusians were visiting Earth in order to help us achieve membership in the Interplanetary Federation. Then Solgrinder led him back to his sleeping bag. Howard Menger. Howard Menger was a New Jersey sign painter. He was visiting his parents' farm one day, when a flying saucer appeared in the sky and landed not far from him. Menger stared dumbfounded as three figures, two men with long blonde hair, and a shapely female, emerged from the craft. They were tall and garbed in jumpsuits. The woman approached Menger and shook his hand. "A feeling of relaxation and well-being consumed me," he would recall in From Outer Space to You, Saucerian Press, 1959. They chatted. The woman claimed to be over 500 years old, a longevity she attributed to the living, thinking, and eating habits of her race. In the years to come, she told Menger, he would be instructed in those habits, and when the time was right, he was to pass the knowledge on to his fellow Earthmen. It was the beginning of a decade of contacts between Howard Menger and the space people. He would rendezvous with their ships, chat with these envoys from a distant planet, and provide, for those of them assigned to live among us, clothing, health food, and haircuts. On one occasion, he delivered to them an entire box of sunglasses, apparently for disguises. He also briefed them on our customs and slang. In return for these services, he was given rides in the saucers. During one of his rides, the saucer approached Venus, making Menger the first Earthman to have viewed the planet close up.
Remark here that all of these so-called Venus contactees had, according to the other space contacts which have been given newer information on these, told, for example, "We, the Nors, have in common with the other elder races that we normally live on a vibrational level, or wavelength, which is much higher than your own. Since your awareness range is a narrow one, we would not, in quotes, exist, so far as your senses are concerned, when we were in our normal state. You would be unaware of us for the same reason that an ordinary radio receiver is unaware of a telecast transmission. You are simply not able to tune up to our channel, yet we are quite solid and real. There are sounds, which your ears cannot hear, and colors, which your eyes cannot see. Yet these are actually just as real as those which register on your senses."
"I saw beautiful dome-shaped buildings," he reports, with tears spiraling upward. "The planet was fantastically beautiful. I did not get the impression of cities. I was reminded of beautiful suburban areas I have seen on our own planet, though, of course, wondrously different. Different too were the vehicles he could see moving about on the surface. They lacked wheels, and seemed to be floating just above the ground." His hosts explained that the wheel, far from being the boon portrayed in our history books, is inimical to a civilization's progress, and the Venusians had been fortunate enough to bypass it. On another occasion, Menger was flown to a base that the space people had established. There he joined a tour group, comprised of scientists, engineers, and astronomers who had been assembled from the nations of the Earth. Everyone exchanged smiles and handshakes. They were served refreshments by space women in flowing gowns. Then the group piled aboard a wheelless train. The train glided along a copper highway, touring a complex of buildings that reminded Menga of a world's fair. Inside the buildings they were shown otherworldly art, and technological wonders such as a sonic wash machine. The train then continued onto the dark side of the moon. Sticking his head out a door, Menga discovered that the lunar heat was intense. With its strange beauty and air of desolation, the moon reminded him of the Nevada desert. The visit concluded with a banquet. After 4 days of this lunar junket, we were finally treated to a huge dinner by our hosts. With such a spirit of happiness and goodwill permeating all of us, it made me wonder if what I was seeing and hearing were not just all a beautiful dream. If it were, I dreamed it with others. And in 1956 Menga was privileged to meet with a space teacher. Clad in a white jumpsuit and blue cape, this advanced being lectured to him via telepathy. Menga learned that supreme consciousness was identical with love, and that the divine plan of which the space people were emissaries was rooted in love. In a New Jersey sign painter, they had found someone to help further that plan. As he left the saucer one night, Menga recalls, "A glorious uplifting emotion permeated my whole being, and again I felt humble and grateful for the privilege of being a small part of such a movement toward universal peace and understanding." Los Angeles aliens. In January 1953, the Missing Persons Bureau of Los Angeles, according to one of its officials, who requested anonymity, temporarily engaged two strange men. Tall, emaciated, and shabbily dressed, the pair were remarkable. Menga probably means rooted. For their pointed ears and bluish-green complexions. Hired to track down missing persons, they astonished their co-workers with a singular ability to do so. And they demonstrated another ability as well. Sitting around the office one day, one of the men scored a deep indentation in a metal filing cabinet, with his finger. It was noticed now that their hands were oddly shaped and jointless. Questioned about this, the pair revealed that they had come to Los Angeles from another planet, having landed their flying saucer in the Mojave Desert. They had learned English, they said, from radio and television broadcasts. The FBI was notified, but the men disappeared before the agent's arrival. An analysis was performed on the dent in the filing cabinet, and unknown elements were detected. Buck Nelson. Buck Nelson, author of My Trip to Mars, the Moon, and Venus, Quill Press, 1956, was a former ranch hand and sawmill operator, who had retired to a small farm in the Ozarks. One afternoon he was startled to see a large disc hovering over his barnyard. Nelson, who says he had never heard of flying saucers, snapped a photo and signaled to the disc with his flashlight. It responded by zapping him with a ray that knocked him to the ground. When the disc had departed, Nelson picked himself up, painlessly, to his surprise. For his lumbago and neuritis, maladies from which he had suffered for years, were gone. Months later the disc returned. This time it landed, and out stepped three men, who struck up a conversation with Nelson. Two of them, he learned, were Venusians. The third, strictly speaking, "This is not a contactee report, no one actually saw these fellows emerge from a flying saucer." But the pointed ears, unearthly complexion, and singular abilities would seem to confirm their claim. Several versions of this tale have circulated, a kind of urban legend, but common to all is the sheer otherworldliness of the pair. Was an Earthman who had emigrated. They asked why he was using batteries for his radio, instead of tapping the free energy of the universe. After describing life on Venus, they got back in their craft and disappeared into the sky. On their next visit they told him to prepare for a trip into space. And on April 24, 1955, the Venusians returned, dictated to Nelson the 12 laws of God, and took him aboard the saucer. He was flown first to Mars and introduced to some of its inhabitants. Nelson says he so resembled them physically that, despite his Western drawl and bib overalls, the Martians were initially unaware of his being a stranger. Then it was on to the Moon and Venus. On Venus, he was shown cars without wheels, a machine that read books aloud, and a 17-hour clock, the period of the planet's rotation, he explains. After 3 days of this extraterrestrial tourism, he was returned to his farm. Danding Horse was an Ottawa who lived in a camp in Oklahoma. On July 12, 1959, he was approached outside his home by three men. They wore uniforms similar to those of bus drivers. One of them introduced himself as Author of Venus, and offered Standing Horse a ride in a flying saucer. At first he resisted the offer. "Oh, not me," Standing Horse told the Venusian. "I'll keep one foot on the earth, sir." But he soon yielded to a strange urge to accompany the men. Standing Horse was led to a waiting saucer, taken inside, and strapped into a chair. The saucer took off, with a sensation he describes as like that of an elevator starting up. A woman appeared and introduced herself as Mondralika. She was the ship's captain, she said, and a native of the planet Orion. Despite Nelson's testimony, astronomers still cling to a belief in a far lengthier Venusian day. Standing Horse looked her over. The lady was tall with pitch black hair, he would recall. She was dressed with a blue sort of jacket with an insignia on her right shoulder. I noted a belt that looked as if it was jeweled, with a long dress. Mondralika was youthful in appearance, though she turned out to be 417 years old. They talked and listened to music. Then Mondralika led him along a circular corridor, on a tour of the ship. They stopped in the control room, the kitchen, and a bedroom where Standing Horse lay down and napped. He was awakened by Mondralika. "Get up now, brother," she said, "for we are nearing Mars." On Mars he was treated to an elaborate meal, and shown corn 18 feet high. After a brief visit to other planets, he was returned to Earth. Gee, I have not included here George Adamski, the best known and most controversial of the contactees. His tale will be told in part 3. Nor have I included any abductees, a type of contactee whose experience is involuntary and often grim. They, too, will be looked at later. The preceding accounts are detailed, vivid, and absolutely attested to by the contactees. After reading them, can anyone doubt that flying saucers are real? Or that these craft are extraterrestrial in origin? Or that ordinary Americans, people like you and me, may be taken aboard? 3. Messengers. It can happen to anyone. Howard Menger, sign painter. Buck Nelson, retired ranch hand. George Van Tassel, mechanic. Truman Beth Thurum, highway worker. Frank Buckshot Standing Horse, Indian chief. These were men from all walks of life. Yet they had something incredible in common. All were contacted by the space people, they tell us, and taken aboard a flying saucer. Why were they chosen for this experience? On account of their superior virtue? Their willingness to cooperate? Their open-mindedness? Or did they just happen to be in a particular place at a particular time? The last seems to have been the case. Which means a flying saucer experience can happen to anyone. Including you or me. So are we ready for that experience? Ready to deal with it, and to do so in an effective way? Dealing with it for most of us. The thought of being taken aboard a UFO boggles the mind. We can scarcely conceive of such an experience. The contactees have published their accounts, and we can read these and shake our heads in wonder. But to imagine actually being on a ship, approaching a porthole, and seeing our own face reflected there, is something else again. Yet the contactees whose tales we have examined, folks much like ourselves, seem to have adapted readily to their situation. Perhaps there is something in the vibes of the space people that induces calm and confidence. Whatever the case, the contactees quickly put behind them any anxieties or doubts, and embraced with enthusiasm the chance to learn about space, improve their health, inspect the propulsion system of a saucer, tour other planets, absorb the wisdom of an advanced race of humans. In short, they put to good use their time aboard a saucer. Fine, you say. But what about later? What about after their return to Earth? Were they able to resume a normal life? Were they able to deal with being publicly identified as a contactee? The answer is a resounding yes. For most of these men not only resumed their life, they thrived. One way or another, upon returning home, they of their flying saucer experience. Let's look at how the contactees thrived. Truman Bethurum told friends about his encounters with Aura Reigns of the planet Clarion. They told others. And word began to spread. Then one day he received a letter from George Adamski, a philosopher who lived on a mountain near San Diego. Professor Adamski, as he styled himself, had been through an encounter of his own, and he wanted to meet with Bethurum to compare notes. Bethurum drove down and told his story. An enthusiastic Adamski recorded it, and asked permission to make the tape available to others. Bethurum told him to go ahead. Adamski had connections among the New Age community of Southern California, and Bethurum was soon receiving letters, telephone calls, and unannounced appearances on his doorstep, from persons wishing to know more about the Space People. A UFO club in Hollywood invited him to speak. The speech brought him newspaper and other publicity. Finally, Bethurum decided to publish an account of his experiences. He hired a ghostwriter to assist him in its preparation. And in 1954, Divorce & Co., a small press in Los Angeles that specialized in the metaphysical, published his Aboard a Flying Saucer. Despite the inclusion of an affidavit from Bethurum's union, attesting to his reliability as a welder, many readers of the book were skeptical. But others accepted as factual this astonishing tale of contact with the Space People. They saw its author as simple, sincere, and forthright, or as endowed with too little imagination to have invented his story. Among the believers, apparently, was Bethurum's wife. In 1956 she divorced him, naming as correspondent Aura Reigns. Bethurum went on to found the Sanctuary of Thought, a meditation center inspired by the ideals of the Space People. George Van Tassel. Not long after his encounter, Van Tassel was able to establish psychic contact with the Aetherians, as he called the human inhabitants of space. And he began to write about them. His best-known book is The Council of Seven Lights, Divorce & Co., 1958, a profile of the governing body of the solar system. He also published a newsletter, dedicated to the diffusion of universal wisdom gained through the medium of space beings. Each issue contained an editorial that had been dictated, telepathically, by an Aetherian, an article, on some spiritual matter, by Van Tassel himself, and the latest news from space. Like much contactee literature, Van Tassel's writings are long-winded and abstruse. But they are fervent, too, the enthusiastic outpourings of a, depending on your view of the man, visionary, crackpot, or humbug. Basically, he takes traditional religion and gives it an outer space spin. Biblical events are interpreted along extraterrestrial lines. The Star of Bethlehem, for example, was actually a UFO, and warnings from the Aetherians about atomic testing and such are passed on to humanity by this modern-day prophet. Van Tassel also founded something called the College of Universal Wisdom. This institute, or ongoing event, attracted a loose assortment of UFO buffs, New Agers, and the curious. They would drive out to Giant Rock for communion with one another and instruction, plus some cosmic titillation. On Friday nights, Van Tassel held a channeling session in the grotto, during which he received messages from the Aetherians. Giant Rock, he explained, was a natural receptor. The session included Kabbalistic ceremonies. Amazingly, these goings-on seemed to have been tolerated by his desert neighbors. Perhaps it was the live and let live code of the West. Or the fact that, despite his role as prophet, Van was in many respects a regular guy, clean-cut, casually dressed, vigorous and cheerful. He was a practical fellow, with a personality that has been likened to that of the manager of a farm equipment company. And indeed, he was a businessman, operating still the airport and a dude ranch. As his fame spread, Van Tassel began to receive visitors from afar. Among these were Bryant and Helen Reeve, a retired couple from Detroit. Fascinated by the UFO phenomenon, the Reeves had climbed into their car and driven about the country, visiting contactees. In their book Flying Saucer Pilgrimage, Amherst Press, 1957, they declare, "We have just seen a great man, a cosmic-minded soul, George Van Tassel. He is an advanced apostle in the New Age if there ever was one. A busy apostle, too." During the course of his career, Van Tassel traveled around the US and Canada, giving hundreds of lectures and making more than 400 radio and television appearances. He continued to publish his newsletter, and to go into trances at the College of Universal Wisdom. Indefatigable, he lectured, wrote, and murmured messages from the Etherians. Yet it was not for his teachings that Van Tassel was best known. Rather, for an annual event he presided over at Giant Rock. Known as the Interplanetary Spacecraft Convention, it was held every spring from 1954 to 1977. The get-together in Saucerdom, the convention never failed to attract thousands of enthusiasts. The scene was reminiscent of a religious camp meeting of old, as believers, a new breed of them, arrived by car, recreational vehicle, or airplane, and camped out in the desert. Van Tassel served as genial host. Featured guests were contactees such as Adamski, Beth Thurum, and Orfeo Angelasi, who gave talks and a few extraterrestrials, too. According to contactee Kelvin Rowe, author of A Call at Dawn, Understanding Publishing Co., 1958, three Plutonians were present at the first convention. They mingled secretly with a crowd, indistinguishable from ordinary convention goers. Angelasi was the most poetical of the contactees. A Los Angeles factory worker, he had a series of UFO experiences that, /ed their books. Pamphlets and souvenirs were hawked to the faithful from makeshift booths. And the carnival atmosphere included a skywatch at night, during which UFOs were frequently sighted. Van Tassel insisted that Giant Rock was a magnet for them. Read like medieval visions. Transported on one occasion to another dimension, he awoke, clad in a white robe and golden belt, on a luxurious couch in a fantastical city. "This is my real world, my true body," he realized. "I have been lost in a dimension called time and a captive in a forbidden land called Earth. But now, somehow, I have come home. All is serenity, peace, happiness and indescribable beauty here. The only disturbing factor is a troublesome memory of an unhappy shadow named Orfeo, a bondsman in a prison world of material called Earth."